Jema. So we continue with the subject of four austerities, and we'll take up mental austerity, and then if time permits we'll go to the second one. Now we have already shared what Mother says about austerity. So austerity, first of all, it's not something which has to be done with a lot of pain or something. For example, with regard to mental austerity, it is not something where you don't speak at all, you say that I am not going to speak. That's not the way. But the way is to speak and to speak sense and to speak that which is needed. That's what austerity is about. It's like not eating food is not austerity of food. It's a kind of force control. So it's not about fasting, but ability to exercise sufficient restraint and mastery. That is the object of austerity. And with the idea of preparing the instrument for the divine expression. So in mental austerities, there are two things. One is meditation, contemplation, concentration, reflection. Mother doesn't speak of that in this particular essay. She has spoken about it at several places, and maybe we'll have to. We have also spoken about it separately, and we'll take it up as a separate subject because it's a highly specialized subject. Not everybody is meant to do meditation, and it doesn't come very easily and naturally. So she's not speaking of that here. Though very roughly, meditation is the ability to focus the mind on a train of ideas around a single idea. It could be the idea of God, it could be the idea of God as love, or it could be the idea of peace, beauty, harmony, anything. And if the mind can go around it, looking at it from several angles, then arrive at a synthesis, that is meditation. It's a mental activity. It teaches the mind to focus itself on one single idea. Then there is concentration, where it's no more idea, or it could be an idea, but an idea, the mind doesn't run around it, but picks up that idea and goes to its core. Or it could be an object, or it could be a subject, simply the divine himself, or it could be any of these things we can pick up, name or a form, and the mind concentrates on that in one of the centers. But here it's not just the mind, normally the entire consciousness is to come into play. We have to withdraw it from external objects, external world engagement. So concentration is not merely an activity of the mind, unlike meditation. Meditation is a mental activity, and concentration is a more internalizing of consciousness, turning it within, taking the help of an idea, object, name, form, and by concentration, piercing, going beyond the form into its essence. Then reflection is an activity which is beautifully given to human beings to separate a part of the mind from the rest and look at, make ourselves our own object or subject of study. It's something unique to humans, seldom used. We are too busy studying others, passing judgment on others. But seldom we really look inside and look, make ourselves our own student. That's how the Gita describes one of the Devi Sampada is Swadhyaya. And it is translated literally as the study of one's own self. So becoming conscious by looking into oneself, self-reflection, discernment, these are higher faculties of the mind. But in this chapter, Mother very beautifully, because practically, she focuses on speech, the mastery of speech. Now speech is an externalizing activity of the externalizing mind. So here we throw not only words, but sounds, energies, and riding on those words is will. Will for good, will for harm. So all kinds of things we throw through speech. And the way we control or regulate our speech, or the way we let loose our speech, we help in doing good or harm to the world. So it's so important to master this faculty of speech, which is unique to human beings. And so Mother speaks about it. Now in speech, first there are a number of words and ideas which the subject, and a lot of it is idle speech. So we need not even talk about austerity here. People sit and they are talking about, you know, what food they had and where the preparation is better, etc., etc. This is simply idle speech. It generally is really a waste of time. One of the forms of speech which mother particularly is cautions us in very, very serious terms is about the harm done by incontinence of speech with regard to gossip, especially when it is combined with slander. Meaning thereby, when you speak about others in very lowly words, abusive language, particularly abusive language, she uses the word slangs, which has become so common today. She uses the word, it's like committing spiritual suicide. So that's something very serious. And mastery over speech, in many ways, even if you look at it logically, shows a high degree of mastery on the whole being. Because speech involves, it is the highest faculty. In, if you look at the gradations of faculties from the, through the plant, animal world into human beings, speech is the highest faculty, and that's why the Vedic Rishis paid so much importance to speech. And that's how, as Shobindu defines, what is a mantra? Mantra is the highest intensity of speech. So speech could be taken to that level where it could create. It was creative in nature. Equally, speech can destroy. So we know its importance. And we have the story of the Tower of Babel, which is being built for man to climb to heaven. And then the devil doesn't know what to do because man will reach. It's a metaphorical, it's an allegory, but very beautiful allegory. So that's the place from where the word Babel of a child comes. So Babel is a place where they are building this tower. And then the devil doesn't know what to do. So he creates confusion in the minds of people. So whatever is said by one person is misunderstood by another. Now we know that the devil is still active. You say one thing, it is understood as something else. And then they begin to fight. So they could never finish the tower. And mother spoke of it with regard to Auroville, that Auroville is an effort to create the Tower of Babel in reverse. So that human effort coming together to make something world beautiful. But the sum and substance of mental austerity is, if you ask me, the lesser we speak, the better it is. And the safer we are. And the safer the world is. Because the world is drowned in sounds and noises of the words. In teaching you have to use words. So she says that is understood. But otherwise, when people mix up together and they start speaking, we have a tendency to be driven by the vital impulse and all kinds of things come out uncontrolled, unregulated. So if you ask me in one sentence, it is the less said, the better it is. So with this background, we'll just read a few passages, just some important ones so that we can also touch upon the other austerity. So regarding control of speech, without going to this extreme where, you know, she is describing, you have to be so conscious of your words. People have taken to two extremes. One extreme is that they will not speak at all. So without going to these extremes, one should always, page 59, one should always control the words one speaks and never allow one's tongue to be prompted by a movement of anger, violence or temper. So many things break. People come and discuss analyzing marital issues, for example, relationship issues. And they're trying to analyze, he did this and she did this and he. But if you go to the root, ultimately, it's all starts by anger. Whatever may be the reason, it could be frustration, it could be anything. Frustration means desire, which ultimately. So anger is such a destructive force. And the Gita also speaks about it. Krodhat bhavati sammoha. It completely deludes the mind, clouds it, takes over, one becomes anger and it's devastating. So she says, never speak when you are moved, this is prompted by a movement of anger, violence, and temper. So initially one has to, maybe one begins to speak, one has to learn to control, offer it, pray, call for peace. Second, when anger is coming or violence, temper is coming, don't speak. That is the next level. So though you are boiling inside, you are not expressing. What do we do with that energy? Offer it at the feet of the divine. Say that I am getting angry. Look into it, that it's probably some frustration, some unfulfilled wish. So learn to control it. And the third level, even before the boiling point has been reached, we become aware that this is where now anger is beginning to enter inside. And put a stop there, maybe stop speaking. If it's too much difficult to control, move away from the place. But don't get caught into that situation. It is not only the quarrel that is bad in its results. And very clearly she says that it is very surprising. She says it's very strange that human beings cannot live without quarreling. And it's so true. And so sadly true. And if you really look at human beings, and that's why when we look at the animal world and the human world, many times you feel that these guys are so much better. They don't do anything, you know. They just at the most, even a dog which is barking, it's not usually anger. And if you just, you know, just make him feel comfortable and he becomes quiet. But human beings, once they start barking, there's no end to it. And it mounts up, it throws vibrations. So sometimes one wonders that whether really humanity is more advanced. Well, in one sense perhaps, or in many ways it is much worse. So she says that it's not only quarrel, but the fact of allowing one's tongue to be used. See, this is an instrument of the divine, should become used to project bad vibrations into the atmosphere. For nothing is more contagious than the vibrations of sound. And by giving these movements a chance to express themselves, one perpetuates them in oneself and in others. So by the very fact, and then strangely nowadays, modern psychology, no, you must express yourself. You are being authentic. It is so dangerous. You are not being authentic. You are being moved by an impulse of anger. That's not your authentic self. Your true self is much deeper, much calmer. It's full of peace, full of light, full of generosity, kindness. This is not true self. And it is being encouraged in the name of, you know, using abusive word is the cool thing, the in thing. So one should be so careful, and these influences are coming from every side. It is dangerous, but then she is the one carrying the ship of the world. So that's our hope. So she says that the vibrations of sound are contagious. And really, once it is out, you can't take back. And it's often said that, well, an arrow, if pierces, you can take it out. But sound, if it is pierced, words, if they pierce, it'll continue. God knows for how long. It'll sink inside. Continue to have its effect much for a very long time. So one should be so careful. Among the most undesirable kinds of idle talk, we should pause and listen. Among the most undesirable kinds of idle talk must also be included everything that is said about others. If this is something which we should write and keep and remind ourselves million times maybe. She's not even saying good or bad. She is saying don't. There is this story of Jugalda who told me himself once that he used to hear Amalda and Niruddha talk a little loudly, because actually they were hard of hearing. And they've grown up like friends in the whole place, so near the Samadhi. So they would, and many people would look up. Apparently some would feel odd, some would feel disturbed. So he sent word to the mother through Andrita that please tell her that I feel like telling them, but they're very senior members. Should I do it or not do it? So the mother sent a reply. If you tell them, they may listen and may progress. But if you don't tell them, you will definitely progress. So, you know, he got the message. And then she says, if you want to tell them, you can tell them once without insistence. and that should be the end of the story. If you feel inspired, speak then, but that should be the end. Don't keep on insisting on the point and no, I am right, you are right, you have done your bit. So this is where she is saying, unless you are responsible for certain people, as a guardian, a teacher or a departmental head, what others do or do not do is no concern of yours. Period. And you must refrain from talking about them, from giving your opinion about them and what they do, and from repeating what others may think or say about them. I have heard stories of like Nalanida, even mother sometimes, people would say things, they want him to say something, then it become authenticated, no? See, Nalanida also, he would just remain quiet, then after some time he'll say, okay. You know, carry on. No opinion, no views, nothing. It was so difficult for people to understand because they want an opinion. And they don't want an opinion, they want a ratification of their opinion. And then it will be quoted, very often misquoted. So one should be so careful about this. And it creates so much chaos. So she says, refrain from talking about them, from giving your opinion about them and what they do, and from repeating what others may think or say about them. This is another part. Somebody says something about someone, and if you don't like that person, so what happens to why you know he is like that? You don't even know. So it is based on somebody else telling you about. He got so angry, he got this, he did this. Then the other person further, if he doesn't like, he will further push it. So by the time it goes, it becomes a swell thing. So she reminding us, don't do it. That's all she's saying. It may happen that the very nature of your occupation makes it your duty to report what is taking place in a particular department. This also, you know, that if you observe something which may be like a dishonesty, something which you feel is not right, many things, anything, she is saying in the department. Undertaking or communal work. But then the report should be confined to the work alone and not touch upon private matters, and an absolute rule, it must be wholly objective. You should not allow any personal reaction, any preference, any like or dislike to creep in. And above all, never introduce your own petty personal grudges into the work that is assigned to you. Very often we see that somebody else doing the same thing, we are very generous if he is a friend. But somebody we don't like doing even half of it or maybe one tenth of it, we see, look here. And we are very keen to observe it and pick it up and report. In all cases, and as a general rule, the less one speaks of others, even to praise them, the better. It is already so difficult to know exactly what is happening in oneself. How can one know with certainty what is happening in others? This is a very hard lesson. And one learns it, one pronounces judgment. When you are young, no, you have this tendency. And then you realize how off the mark one could be. So it's best to remain quiet. And it should be with humility that I really don't know. How do I know what's happening in which person? As a general rule for the ashram, I feel ultimately what I have learnt and taken as my own little yardstick. I will see everybody who is here, everybody who is connected with mother here. By that I mean, he is called by the Divine Mother. At some level he is connected with mother. That's it. That's all that matters. On that ground we all can meet. Rest is not my business. But it's learnt with very hard way. I have learnt it the hard way. But it's so true that ultimately mother has called. She knows why, what, who am I to see. I have to just look into myself. That is why one must. So she says, when a thought is expressed in speech, the vibrations of the sound has a considerable power to bring the most material substance into contact with the thought, thus giving it a concrete and effective reality. I had a discussion yesterday with some youngster and the same thing. No, if you observe, you must tell. This is how the norm is nowadays. Say, how do you know what is really happening? We We say, I'm speaking the truth. How do you know the truth? What is your basis and criteria for truth? You have your own yardstick and understanding. Based on that, you are saying that this is true. But you really don't know what's happening inside. That is why one must never speak ill of people or things or say things which go against the progress of the divine realization in the world. This is an absolute general rule. So I have seen this, some of these old time sadhaks, and I have seen something very beautiful about them, that if you go and complain about someone, something like this, then the person, one person remarked me something very interesting. Not me, someone else, and that person told me that, you know, I was so touched by that remark. I said, yes, something very beautiful. So the person remarked that, well, if I look into myself carefully, I see something of that element is in me also. Such an honest way of looking at it. And so the person left it at that. The other person I have seen that, well, at the end, after a conversation with some people, so the second person is a lady, she is taking her tea with all of us. Then suddenly she says, what have we got to do with all this? The person works well. End of the story. And these two people, both are literally, if you want to see an example of karma yoga, absolutely get rid of preference, look at thing objectively just as it is. And it can be very much misunderstood. Both, I can mention, they are both alive. One is Vijay Bhai, the other is Tara Didi. What an inspiration. Focus on work, that's it. You may be understood, not understood, from the point of view of mother's work. And there are people with whom you learn all these things, you know. They are not something which you find in just only reading, but when you meet people, it really helps. So she speaks of that another aspect of mental austerity, carefully avoid any exchange of ideas that leads to controversies, which are all too often bitter and nearly always unnecessary, or any clash of opinion which ends in heated discussions and even quarrels. This is something which is so important. I remember once being abroad, some of us were there, and one of the persons was a very strong India lover, and the other person was a very equally strong lover of his or her country, and you know, I knew this is going to spark off many fires. So I had to say, see, just understand. Everybody has a right to love their country and feel about it the way they do. You may understand or not understand, it's a different story. But the person has a right. And it's quite natural. Patriotic sentiments are not incompatible with yoga. If the person feels, you have to respect that, not get into. So especially political discussions is totally to be avoided. People don't realize, and that was one thing which long back some program, some kind of lit fest was being held here in the society premises. So I was asked about it. I said, see, I've spoken there, but if you ask me, should it be held? I would say no. Because right now it is one group of people, politicians, whom I may like in my personal. But tomorrow you have opened a door. What will prevent if somebody else brings? Today you may be right, another may be left. And they are one-sided opinion, all said and done. Even the best opinion is all one-sided opinion. Every party justifies itself with their business. And when you vote, you don't vote based on that. You have your own understanding how you want to exercise your vote. But to engage in that, politics is one thing. That's why mother said, no politics, one of the things in the ashram. And the reason is very simple. It is the one area which leads to maximum. I have seen families getting separated in the house, you know, people fight, husband, wife getting divorced. So politics discussions are best out. So, as if we are going to decide by our discussion. So, and then she says another part is that it's a mental narrowness which takes up one viewpoint, fights to impose itself. And then she quotes in, I once heard an old occultist of some wisdom say, nothing is essentially bad. There are only things which are not in their place. It is so beautiful. For each thing in its true place, and put each thing in its true place, and you will have a harmonious world. Means don't have absolute ideas of anything. This is, like for instance, some people, war is necessarily bad. No. Lot of wars have been so useful in clearing the path for mankind. You can't have an absolute idea and then fight over it. War can be very good, war can be very evil, depending on the context and where you put it. So that's what she is speaking of. So, toward the end, she says something very interesting. As for the disciple, I would tell him, Mother tells to us, and it's something we should remember always, because very often we even get into a discussion about the guru, the master, what he is speaking, and you know, I believe, I don't believe. Recently some monk is trying to write a book on Sri Aurobindo, and he says, I don't think he realized the supermind. I mean, what do you say? But more interesting was another person who is a sannyasi, very revered sannyasi, in a monastic order. So someone sent me a book. He has already purchased the volumes on the Gita and asked my opinion. So first I said, generally if you ask me, it's not good to pine on anyone. He is respected by people. But if you ask my opinion, by default, a sannyasi is not qualified to speak about the Gita. Because the Gita says sannyas, it doesn't recommend sannyas, it speaks of tyaga. And you cannot speak about something if you have not been sincere to its practice. So I can speak on something which I am trying to practice, but I can't speak on something which I am not, you know, trying to practice. I can have a very general opinion about it, that's it. So Gita is a book of action, to a man of action, to a man who renounces his inner egoism, but not an external activity. And sannyas by nature is monastic order. I see it's a paradox, but your viewpoint you asked me, so I have given you. But basically, you decide. You decide after reading. So, as to the guru, she says, in all cases, be faithful to your guru, whoever he is. He will lead you as far as you can go. But if you have the good fortune to have the divine as your guru, there will be no limit to your realization. Now, this is a master stroke. At the end of all things, basically she is saying, why is she saying in mental austerity? She is saying the guru's word is guru's word. Just listen. You may not understand it. Receive it. Reflect upon it. Pray. Let me know the inner sense of the words, and the words will disclose and follow it. So that's one place where an unquestioning obedience is expected of a disciple. That's why she says, and if it is the word of the divine, then. So other days, yesterday somebody was asking, I mentioned about Arjun as a bhakta. Arjun was a bhakta. He said, exactly. One of the greatest bhaktas. And Sri Krishna tells it in so many words, why I am giving you the greatest secrets. He says, I am giving you the paramam vachaham. Why? He says, because you have started taking delight in me as a bhakta. And then Sri Aurobindo says, what is bhakti? He says, to take delight in the Lord. So see, what a stereotype is broken? Bhakti, going to temple with all this khartal, manjira. No, Arjun is fighting a war. But look at the unquestioning obedience. He questions to clarify concepts. He doesn't doubt Sri Krishna's word. He just says, I just want to be clear what you are really expecting of me. And when he is clear, he says, Nashto Moha. Done. I am going to fight whoever comes in front of me. Because this is your word. This is the sign of ultimate bhakti. The word of the master is ultimate. There is no question. And that's how the greatest secret is revealed to one like Arjun. And finally she says, in conclusion, I would say this. If you want your speech to express the truth and thus acquire the power of the word. Now, you know, often it's very interesting when you read something of the mother, you sit and pause. Power of the word. Speech should express truth. Now our mind will give all kinds of suggestions. But what she is saying is something very interesting. She says, in conclusion, I would say this. If you want your speech to express the truth and thus acquire the power of the word, Never think out beforehand what you want to say. Do not decide what is a good or bad thing to say. Do not calculate the effect of what you are going to say. Be silent in mind. She's not saying just speak randomly like a, you know, machine gun. She's saying be silent in the mind. Be quiet. And remain unwavering in the true attitude of constant aspiration towards the all wisdom, the all knowledge, the all consciousness. Then, if your aspiration is sincere, if it is not a veil for your ambition to do well and to succeed, I must speak well, people must be impressed, there should be so many likes and all these things. If it is pure, spontaneous and integral, you will then be able to speak very simply, to say the words that ought to be said, neither more nor less, and they will have a creative power. My own formula is very simple. Because I am in this work, I go pray to Mother before the talk that this time I'll be there. Actually, before any activity, but Mother, I have to speak this time to this time. You be present in the audience, become the audience, become the speaker, become the speech, become the tongue, mouth, everything. And then when I go, I just pray to her, just silent prayer that by your permission may I sit and may it be you who speaketh through me. That's the end of the story. What you are going to say and which way, if you plan, okay. That's why these diagrams, people often ask. People often say in some conferences, please send us your write-up. I said, if you tell me, I'll send you. But I don't guarantee at all that I'll speak a word from the write-up. Chutnarayan ji had a very humorous way of putting it, which I love. So people would ask him, what topic should you? So he would say, he would say something, but to me he said, I'll tell you in Hindi, then I'll tell you in English. Are unko kuch bhi de dene do, bolunga to wo jo maa bulwayengi. Let them give any subject, I am going to speak what mother will make me speak. So other day someone sent me a program of the US and said, these are the little changes in the topics we had given you. I said, it doesn't matter. Are you okay with it? I said, what is important is mother's consciousness should be transmitted to the extent that one is ready and open and capable of it. All the rest is unimportant. So, okay, you can tweak the... But some people love to, you know, no, this topic this way may be better. That's a very mentalized way of looking at it. And now comes the austerity of feelings. Feelings, austere, yes. Feelings also we throw like God knows... I'm reminded of a line in a song, Mere dil ke tukde hajar huye, ek yahan gira ek wahan gira. All around, like strings, we are linked to the whole world. And starts with relatives and goes to this attachment, that attachment. So, obviously, there is very little left at the end of the day to love God. Because all this love is circulating in a pool and muddle. Of course, there are questions which he'll answer, so we'll wait for that. So she says, the power of love is the most difficult to handle. And something very interesting, and yet men have invented all kinds of... So she says, in the name of love, the worst crimes have been perpetrated, the greatest follies committed. And yet men have invented all kinds of moral and social rules in the hope of controlling this force of love, of making it amenable and docile. We know it doesn't work. She is confirming it. She says, but these rules seem to have been made only to be broken. Look at the touch of humor. And the restraint they impose on its free activity merely increases its explosive power. You try to control it, it explodes. You see that story of Bhagwati Charan Varman, which a movie was made, Pradeep Kumar, and it's about the sannyasi, Chitralekha. So there this sannyasi, so he has remained in a monastery. See, he has restrained himself from all kinds of things. Then one day the prince calls him. Prince is a karma yogi. And there is a courtesan who loves the prince. And then when she sees this man, what is sannyasi, she falls in love. Because it's like a very different... quality altogether, no? A man who is unaffected. So she requests him that, can I come with you and start staying in your monastery? He never allowed anyone, but he allowed. And then he falls for her. And whatever else follows. And then if he is so miserable, because this all explodes, he has never handled this energy. The movie ends a little dramatically, but in a very different way, that he is feeling all guilty and wants to drown himself in Ganga. He is feeling so sad that I lost my years of sadhana. And as he is going to drown in Ganga, he is bit by a cobra. And then he says, thank you, Vishwanath, Lord, you have saved me. I would have committed suicide, which was much worse. At least you came and saved me by this cobra, in the form of this cobra bite. But see, this is a problem. You try to do it and the moment you are exposed, it can explode. So she says, it doesn't work. So what is the way? Step by step, she will tell us. For it is not by rules that the movement of love can be disciplined. Only a greater, higher and truer power of love can subdue the uncontrollable impulses of love. So the mother used to say this, and one of the ladies told me, this is there in other places also. She said, if you feel love for someone, don't crush it. You refine it, purify it. It was so beautiful. The lady herself said, now she is no more. Said, mother would say this when young girls would go to her and said, she would say, don't crush it. Refine it. Purify it. And I could see in her own life, despite all the suffering she underwent, in this, the course of this love, she really purified. It was her path to progress. And I have seen other people also. So you can't control restraint mentally. Love will find its way, and because it's unrefined, it'll take its own path. But if you take to ones that, okay, I'm going to purify, that means a truer love, a more beautiful love, a higher love, a more divine love, getting rid of all the dark elements of love, the baser elements of love, jealousy, sexuality, and all these things, then ultimately this energy will get purified. So that's what she is reminding us. Only love can rule over love by enlightening, transforming and exalting it. So ultimately the divine love. So that's the alchemy. For here too, more than anywhere else, control does not consist of suppression and abolition, but of transmutation, a sublime alchemy. This is really tapasya. Much more difficult than simply shutting the doors. This is because of all the forces at work in the universe, love is the most powerful, the most irresistible. Without love, the world would fall back into the chaos of inconscience. And then among her many mahavakya, one of them, one of the ones which I love so much, consciousness is indeed the creatrix of the universe, but love is its savior. And then she describes what is its origin. It's the joy of identity, union and identity. And so there are two things involved in love. One is the irresistible power of attraction, and the second is giving. So man is, in its highest sense, it's attraction toward the ultimate. And then how do you reach that point? You may be attracted, but if you want to appropriate, with divine, it's absolutely, you want to limit the divine. You say you have bhakti for the divine, but you want to limit it to my idea of, you know, what the divine should do, not do for me, then ultimately you will limit. But she says, irresistible attraction, on the other hand, a complete self-giving. So when these two come, that is bhakti. Irresistible attraction. Then even human love actually can become, have that caliber. That was the whole idea of sati. But so difficult because human beings come with different shapes and sizes and colors and price tags of the ego. So it's so difficult. With the divine, it's much easier because he won't shout at you or whatever. So that's the big advantage. But yeah, when divine takes a human form, see the same jealousies. People writing to mother, you looked at the person little more than at me. You smiled at him, but when I went near, you were very grim. What wrong have I committed? Look at Shiv in the letter, jealousies, abhiman, all this, and he's replying, no, there is nothing wrong here. about you. In fact, the mother was saying that he has progressed so much and the person is feeling the other way around. So it is when divine takes a human form, all the more. So that's the whole thing. So she describes about this power of love through attraction and giving of oneself. And then in different trees, plants, everywhere, it's the attraction towards the heights, towards something. And that's why when we, often in human love, this is what I suggest. I said, you may do patri, you may do whatever you want to, kundali match. And basically, you know, you don't love the person. You are loving an image. It's your ideal. And very often, developed human beings put that image onto the other person and expect the person is this. And when the person is not this, the image crashes. Even with divine it happens. You have an image of the divine. And the date divine does not fulfill your idea of him. Then instead of saying, doesn't matter, I give myself to you. Say, no, this is not the divine I want. I want to change my God. Want to go to another guru. If this is the murti, she uses that word that, you know, people drown. That idol, that this idol is not fulfilled. So it's so difficult to love. Because it's all about giving oneself completely. So she says how it takes in different forms and different. In animals, it is love that lies behind hunger and thirst. The need for appropriation. See, this is where human says, glorify this kind of human love. No, this is simply an extension of the animal. If you go in the animal kingdom, there is a fight. Pride of lions, and then you see for the lion king. So they fight between each other and decide who will have the family. All higher animals, lower animals like, they are a different breed altogether. But higher, they fight, literally they fight. But after the child, baby, they walk away. Which is so strange. Actually, when you observe it, so you can see the game of nature, and exactly this is how it unfolds in human beings. So she says, in animals it is love that lies behind hunger and thirst. The need for appropriation, expansion, procreation, in short, behind every desire, whether conscious of or not. And among the higher species, not human. See, she's using the word higher species, which means elephants, horses, you'll see. And among the higher species, it is in the self-sacrificing devotion of the female to her young. And he says, I've seen animals do it. Only they don't have words to glorify it. A cat will go, even birds, you see, it's so amazing. They will bring food and ensure that the young one takes care. And if they have less, they will first feed the young. They'll not eat first. They'll first feed the young. Then later on, they will eat. And you can see the joy they are experiencing in simply giving that to their young people, young ones. So it's not like in human beings, mothers are. Unfortunately, many mothers, when I hear it, I find so strange, who are just expecting money from their child. For them, the son is an ATM or the daughter is an ATM card. And it's very sad to see that. Animals are better. Because they at least feed that. They don't have expectation. When I am old, my young one will bring food to me. This, they don't have this expectation. It's so beautiful that, you know, they. So she says that this brings us quite naturally to the human race, in which with the triumphant advent of mental activity, this association reaches its climax, for it has become conscious and deliberate. So she speaks about this, and then, well, she says different kind of people, but now we come to what we should do. But first she says, why do we feel joy in love? What is the reason for this joy? It's because we step out of the ego temporarily. And therefore this giving, this extending beyond the little boundary, that gives the joy of love. But after some time, people use, oh, he's treating me like this, or she's treating me like a... Everything comes back. Like a doormat and like this. Ego, Mr. Ego. How can I... He's not... But if you continue to really love truly, you will discover the origin of love. When I used to read these stories, one of them was story of Asati, who loved not a rishi. She didn't love a rishi. She loved a drunkard who used to go every night to sleep with a woman. Not that this is an ideal way she followed to take love to its highest possibility. So one night, and he is turned a leper. Even some other stories of rishis also are like that. So he is miserable. She says, okay, I'll see what. So she's trying to help him. And then suddenly, there is an Akashvani that he is going to die by the morning. Whatever you may do, you can't do anything about it. He is going to die that next morning. With a tapasya of just simply loving this powerfully, she says, son has to stop. It's a very interesting story. And then it's so difficult for day to break upon the world. And as the story goes, the gods come. And Arundhati, who is a sati herself, she says, please, you can't do adharma in the name of love. And then she finally releases. So it's like the power of love can be raised to any limit. But it's very difficult to sustain it. So here she says, each time an individual breaks the narrow limitations in which he is imprisoned by his ego and energies into the open air through self-giving, whether for the sake of another human being or his family, his country or his faith, he finds in this self-forgetfulness a foretaste of the marvelous delight of love. And this gives him the impression that he has come into contact with the divine. But most often, it is only a fleeting contact. For in the human being, love is immediately mixed with lower egoistic movements, which debase it and rob it of its power of purity. But even if it remained pure, this contact with the divine existence would not last forever, for love is only one aspect of the divine, an aspect which here on earth has suffered the same distortions as the others. The line in Savitri where how the breath of falsehood spoils everything, and there Shrivindu writes, even love and light under their darkness's spell. Even love and light means these are the highest powers, wisdom and love. Even they were distorted by the breath of falsehood. She says that is the difficulty. And therefore, first find the soul, then talk about soulmate. First find the higher consciousness, then talk about higher love. Until then, it's all on the journey. That's okay. Journey is understandable that you'll have friends, you'll have people whom you feel love for and all that, but don't delude oneself. So that's what she says. For one who has known love for the divine, all other forms of love are obscure and too mixed with pettiness and egoism and darkness. Actually, the more you come closer to the divine and feel that love, you become almost intolerant in a way of the pettiness of human love. It becomes so difficult to see that because you have tasted the ultimate touch. And then it strikes you as something very harsh, very hard, like bristles. And, you know, it's very difficult to see that, well, this is what love is. This is what you said is love. It's not love. Because you know what love is. That's where the problem comes. So what it has become here, they are like a perpetual haggling or a struggle for supremacy and domination. And even among the best, they are full of misunderstanding and irritability, of friction and incomprehension. Moreover, it is a well-known fact that one grows into the likeness of what one loves. Therefore, if you want to be like the divine, love him alone. Beautiful. But now comes what to do with people. So she gives a step-by-step formula. Since we have decided to reserve love in all its splendor for our personal relationship with the divine, we shall replace it in our relations with others by a total, unwearing, constant and egoless kindness and goodwill that will not expect any reward or gratitude or even any recognition. So if you have such a person in your life, be blessed. who will not recognize, who will not do. You have such a beautiful chance to learn to love truly. So, because you have known that love, there is no way you can, human beings can. But there are human beings in your life, different reasons. So what you should do is, this is the chance for you to practice an constant, unwavering goodwill, kindness, love with no reward. These are shades of love, of course. She doesn't use the word love. Without any reward, without any return, without any expectation, free of egoism, and of course, not even acknowledgement. This is the not easy, but she is telling us this is the path, or even any recognition. She qualifies further. However others may treat you, you will never allow yourself to be carried away by any resentment. And in your unmixed love for the divine, you will leave him sole judge as to how he is to protect you and defend you against the misunderstanding and bad will of others. How beautiful this is. To learn to have true feelings towards human beings. This is the way. So what about our joys and everything in love? We'll expect only from the divine. So she makes it very clear. You will await your joys and pleasures from the divine. Alone. In him alone will you seek and find help and support. He will comfort you in all your sorrows. Guide you on the path. Lift you up if you stumble. And if there are moments of failure and exhaustion, he will take you up in his strong arms of love and enfold you in his soothing sweetness. She concludes. In summary, austerity in feelings consists then of giving up all emotional attachment. Attachment is egoism in love. Wanting in love. Seeking something. It may be behind cover, at least recognition, at least some praise, something. All this is attachment. So she says, all emotional attachment of whatever, it makes you suffer. Attachment brings suffering. Because as long as the person is towing your line, or the day the person, you know, turns back, says things which are hurtful. And in human nature, it's bound to be there. So you shrink, you start saying, see, this is the person I love. Then you have lost. That's how sadhana khatam ho gayi. You were doing the sadhana of love. And when a person did that, you have actually lost all that accumulated energy. So he said, leave it to the divine. He knows. He knows you. Nobody else needs to know. Nobody else needs to understand. So she says, giving up of all emotional attachment of whatever nature, whether for a person, for the family, for the country, or anything else. She is distinguishing between love and attachment. We must know that. So, love is actually, if we want to put it in very simple words from the right, love is to give. Attachment is, as they use a very interesting phrase, no strings attached is love. Strings attached is attachment. And literally in occult vision, you can see this attachment as strings all around. They say with strings you are tied. There is. One may say, no, I am loving without any expectation. No. There is something hidden. Maybe not from the person, but you may want to play the role of a hero. You may want to do. Something is there which is you are blind to. And you have to get rid of this and let just the mother flow through you all around. So she says, for the country or anything else, in order to concentrate on an exclusive attachment for the divine, this concentration will culminate in an integral identification and will be instrumental to the supramental realization upon earth. This is hard is the path, sharp as a razor edge. Path of love is not easy. And so she says, this leads us quite naturally to the four liberations, which will be the concrete forms of this attachment. She closes this whole chapter. The liberations of feeling will be at the same time the liberation from suffering. Today somebody had posted on the group very rightly, your suffering is an indication of, I am paraphrasing, but something like that. It's an insincerity hidden somewhere. It's ego hidden somewhere. It's a barometer which tells you that, look here, boy, too early to rejoice. Freedom, liberation brings joy automatically. Then the other is the mental liberation or liberation from ignorance will establish in the being the mind of light or Gnostic consciousness, whose expression will have the creative power of the word. Mastery over speech, practicing inwardness, all that she has just now told us, it will give the word a creative power and mind of light. She is using the word Gnostic consciousness. The consciousness which is in the mind, involved in the mind in man, will automatically get liberated and rise to the higher and higher levels. This is what it means. Because normally this mental consciousness is thrown out in all kinds of speech. Conserve it. Turn it upwards and then it will constantly ascend. The vital liberation or liberation from desire gives the individual will the power to identify itself perfectly and consciously with the divine will and brings constant peace and serenity as well as the power which results from them. Freedom from desire equals to peace, serenity, felicity and the power, because desire wastes our energy. Finally, crowning all the others comes the physical liberation or liberation from the law of material cause and effect. This will cause this illness, this will cause that. By total self-mastery, one is no longer a slave of nature's laws, which make men act according to subconscious or semi-conscious impulses and maintain them in the rut of ordinary life. With this liberation, one can decide in full knowledge the path to be taken, choose the action to be accomplished, and free oneself from all blind determinism, so that nothing is allowed to intervene in the course of one's life but the highest will, the truest knowledge, the supramental consciousness. Is the tapasya given by Sri Aurobindo and the mother. People often ask, no? What is to be done? Here, this is to be done. And they expect some another teaching method of doing meditation. People are doing it in the name of Sri Aurobindo, teaching some meditation technique, nothing but guided imagery. Rehash of all that. This is where the difficulty lies. All different domains, mind, heart, vital, physical. This is the tapasya. Jai Maa.